We have Professor Ryan Eustis with us. Let me introduce him. Professor Ryan Eustis is working at the Department of Naval Architecture and Marine Engineering of the University of Michigan. And he's the head of the Perceptual Robotics Laboratory at the same university. They are working on several topics that somehow overlap, not only with visual perception, but also with other courses, like the one in autonomous robots, and so on. He's working on simultaneous localization and mapping, and he's working on a number of techniques that somehow overlap with the different courses that you have here in this semester. So, Ryan, thank you very much. Just let you know that we're going to have a two-hour seminar today, and we have another two-hour seminar on Monday from 9 to 11. Okay?
What is it?
So, Ryan, thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great. Well, so thank you very much for your attendance today. The first talk that I'll give today is going to be related to computer vision applied in an underwater environment. And the application that we're going to be looking at is applying it to the task of trying to do a visual autonomous ship hull inspection. So the idea is that we have a ship like an aircraft carrier, and we want to basically throw a robot in the water, and we'd like to be able to automatically map the entire below water surface portion of the hull. And one of the things that we need to do in order to achieve that task is to precisely navigate the vehicle in that subsea environment. So I run the Perceptual Robotics Lab back at the University of Michigan. So we have a number of different areas that we work in. One I'll be talking about today is this area of the real-time visual SLAM, applying in an underwater environment. We also work in the area of cooperative navigation. So the idea is putting many autonomous underwater robots in the water column and having them instrumented with acoustic modems so that they can transmit state information between the vehicles and try to basically navigate as a group of vehicles. And then the talk I'm going to be giving on Wednesday will be related to the other hat that I wear, which is in the land robotics community, working on autonomous vehicles, cars. So here I work with Ford Motor Company, and on this talk we'll be talking about using basically 3D LiDAR and omnidirectional camera imagery for navigation and perception in urban environments. And then the test bed that we have in my lab, so basically we have a couple of autonomous underwater vehicles that we run in my lab, as well as we have a Segway, a ground robot, and a quad rotor. So for this talk, I just want to acknowledge my PhD students, in particular the Ayon Kim does a lot of work with me on this, and Nick Bianco, and collaborators. So this work is joint with some folks at MIT, and Bluefin Robotics is actually the group that makes this robot here. Okay. All right, so the task with autonomous ship hull inspection, basically we're being funded from a security standpoint to want to be able to inspect and monitor harbor and port environments. And normally, if you want to inspect the hull of a ship in an underwater environment, the way you do that now would be to put humans in the water, divers, and have them swim around and basically visually try to map the area. However, that's not quantitative. It's more of a qualitative metric in terms of how the humans are able to localize themselves underwater. And you could also think about using a robotic system to do that, but in both cases, either the human or the robotic system, knowing where you are relative to the hull is a hard problem. One traditional way to do this would be to instrument the environment. So what you can see dangling off the ship here is a schematic illustration of basically hanging acoustic beacons off the ship or mooring them to the seafloor. And so with this acoustic beacon system, what you can do is measure basically time of flight using speed of sound through the water. And that then allows you to basically, if you know where these beacons are, the relative geometry allows you to triangulate and get an XYZ kind of position estimate for either the robot or the human in that environment. And what we're trying to work on in this project is to eliminate this infrastructure. So the idea is basically have a turnkey system where basically we plop the robot in the water, we don't have to set anything up, and just let it go and survey the hull. So in terms of doing this task, the idea is basically the robot's either going to be making horizontal slices along the below water portion of the hull or what we call vertical slices. And the kind of data that we're collecting while the robot's doing this, we're collecting sonar acoustic imagery of the hull as well as camera optical imagery. And so that's the data that you're using to basically survey the hull to see if there's any foreign objects possibly placed on it. And at the same time, from an engineering standpoint, we'd like to use that same data stream to help the robot localize. So in this case, the camera imagery. We'd like to be able to use it in a SLAM framework, simultaneous localization and mapping, to help keep the robot well localized and navigated with respect to this below water portion of the hull. So here's a depiction of the vehicle and kind of what it's seeing. So basically it's going to be, it's a hovering, so it's called HAV for hovering autonomous underwater vehicle. Basically it can move in all degrees of freedom. So it can move in the XY plane, control depth, yaw, it's passively stable in pitch and roll. We have a camera and a sonar system mounted on the front of the vehicle, and it's actuated so that basically the camera and the sonar can always look basically perpendicular to the hull at any point. So as we change and the hull curvature changes, we're actually actuating the camera and the sonar system so it's always looking nadir to the hull. So on the vehicle itself, what we're seeing here is this is a front view of the vehicle. Some of the different instruments to point out are worth noting. So this sensor right here is a Doppler velocity log. I'll talk a little bit about this. This sensor basically allows us to measure the vehicle's velocity with respect to the hull of the ship. So we can integrate this to get a dead reckon estimate of where we think the vehicle is. On the side of the vehicle, we have basically a camera. So this is a monocular camera system, grayscale, mounted in an underwater housing. We have an LED light for illumination. This is the Ditson sonar. So this is an imaging sonar that basically creates an acoustic picture of the hull. And then you can see the thrusters. So we have some a configuration of thrusters that, again, allows us to move in the horizontal plane as well as control depth and yaw. And so as the vehicle is doing one of these kind of vertical slice surveys, what you're seeing here is basically this would be the camera image footprints if we were to project them onto the surface of the hull. So you can see we have imagery with lots of overlap in this case. And what you're seeing is the resulting trajectory of the robot. So the blue is showing the trajectory of the robot. And all these red links that you see here, those are basically measurements that are being derived from the visual perception system. So anytime that we're able to do the computer vision and automatically register different images that have overlap along the hull, it gives us a chance to provide a relative pose constraint to our estimation framework and allows us to basically control the drift or bound the error growth in the robot's trajectory estimate. So the two types of data streams that we have, this is will be the optical camera imagery that you're seeing. This would be the real-time view of the frame. And then this would be the sonar acoustic imagery of the environment. So this movie I'm going to play here, this is actually a trial that we did just a couple of weeks ago on one of the U.S. Coast Guard vessels. So this is the vessel here. You see we're working on a little workboat. What we're seeing here depicted is basically the output of our real-time visual SLAM display. So what we have on this vehicle is that the vehicle has a tether. So what that allows us to do is basically offload all the computational aspect to a laptop. So basically we're sitting here on the boat. We're streaming all the imagery data up to their laptop, and we're doing the real-time visual SLAM with the system. And this is our kind of visualization display that we have for it. So what you're seeing here is that as the robot's moving along, when you see red links happening, those are successfully registered camera pairs. And what we're doing right now is we set up a series. Let me just restart this so I can kind of narrate it a little bit. So as the vehicle's navigating, you're going to see that we're going to place. So what you're seeing is basically this is the live camera footprint. This would be the imaging volume of the sonar system. Okay, so they're looking in different directions on the vehicle, with respect to the vehicle. We're navigating along. You see we're starting to place some breadcrumbs. So the human operator is actually picking out these are interesting waypoints, okay, along the hull where there's some kind of interesting feature happened. And we're using this to basically demonstrate that we can drive back to waypoints using our SLAM state estimate and that it's working. So what you're going to see is here, when we're driving back to a waypoint, this happens to be the reference image at that waypoint. And so if our SLAM state estimate is correct, once we get back to that waypoint, we should see the same features show up in our current live view in the display. And so you can see that happening there. So we're able to use the SLAM system basically to navigate precisely back to any region along the hull. And so you can see it basically in this case, the track line spacing between the individual track lines is over 4 meters in spacing. So we don't have side-to-side camera overlap here. But anytime that the vehicle drives back horizontally and crosses over its own path, gives us an opportunity to do the visual perception and register and localize the vehicle. So as you can see here, anytime, so basically the spacing here is about 4 meters. There's no camera overlap between these track lines, but as we drive back and forth over our track lines, we're able to get loop closure constraints from the camera system. And so this is shown a surface reconstruction of the hull using the altitude measurements from the, so the Doppler velocity log allows us to measure scene depth. And now what we're depicting here is the final estimated trajectory. So this view right here, don't have an easy way to pause that, unfortunately. But let me skip to the next one. So what I'm going to show you, let me just set this up. So this is going to be the final resulting trajectory. Now, this is the XYZ trajectory of the robot as displayed in space. What we're going to show next is you're going to see we're actually going to take the trajectory and we're going to elevate it in time. Okay, so the Z-axis is now going to represent time, so that you can more clearly see where loop closure constraints happened. Okay, so that basically, when we elevate it in time, you see large vertical links here. It's showing that basically we're registering images that were taken very far apart in time, and those are provided with loop closure constraints. So here we're showing all the camera constraints, and now obviously we're showing it in versus time. So you can clearly see these are like loop closure events where the vehicle is navigated for a long period of time, and then come back to a region and re-recognize that it's back at that same region. Okay. So,
Ryan,
yeah.
In here, are you using both the optical camera and the deep
sun? Yeah, that's a good point.
The
exactly. So, my portion of this work, so this project's joint with MIT. So, we share the same state estimation engine. So basically, the kind of graphical model framework that I'll talk about today in terms of how we actually estimate the robot's trajectory. My portion of the work focuses on how do I derive these constraints using the camera system, the optical camera system. And there's another, some folks at MIT, Horta Johnson and Michael Kess, that work on how to use the Ditson imagery to also generate constraints. But both those constraints get fused in the same estimation framework. So we're able to basically use both camera-derived measurements and sonar-derived measurements for localization. So,
which means that you need to calibrate the position and rotation of the camera.
Yes. Yeah. So both. So both of these are So basically, calibrating each of the sensors with respect to the vehicle frame. Yeah. So the Ditson. So the camera is actually more powerful the way we use it. So the camera provides us with a highly accurate, basically relative pose constraint. And with the camera system, we're able to measure not only translational displacement, but also orientation. The way that they're using the Ditson imagery is basically they're just using it to basically do a correlation and measure just an XY kind of translational measurement. So the Ditson is providing less constraints the way it's being used than the camera system. So I thought the way I would break up my talk is basically one into some background. Okay, so I thought, since this is a lecture, to go through and give you some background, what would be traditional underwater navigation methods, leading us then into some advanced methods such as SLAM, and then our particular formulation of the SLAM problem, which is to use what we call a pose graph SLAM formulation. Okay, and we'll talk about extended information filters. And I think we'll take a break, and then we'll do switch into part two, which is now that we have this machinery that we've talked about, let's actually apply it to really understanding that video that I showed you at the beginning, okay, in terms of what goes into actually making and driving the camera measurement. So we'll talk about the two-view registration framework that we have. We'll talk about how we can try to quantify and measure the utility or the interestingness of the imagery for doing visual SLAM. And then we'll talk about a multi-view registration framework. So for part one, this idea is that in underwater navigation, we have a variety of platforms. Okay, so we have ranging from manned vehicles such as Alvin. So this is a submersible that can dive to 4,500 meters of depth, and it can carry three people. Okay, to robotic systems such as the Jason ROV, which is something that's about the size of, it's bigger than Rafa's car, right? It's about the size of an SUV. It's a fairly big vehicle, but it's fully robotic. Okay, so there's no humans in this, but it has a tether up to the surface ship. And so you can think about this as the world's most expensive video game. There's somebody up on a surface ship driving and piloting this ROV around, and it has the ability to carry several camera systems, sonars, water quality sensors. And the nice thing about the ROV is that because you have the tether, you can offload the computational aspects, so all the processing can actually happen aboard on a whole series of desktops and workstations up on the ship. as well as power is the big advantage. So you also are able to transmit power through the tether to the ROV, such that they can have a huge number of lights, basically, on the ROV, and you can light the place up very well, because you're not concerned about energy. And then we have the class of vehicles, which are AUVs. So these are autonomous underwater vehicles. And you can think about them, they're very much akin to the ROV system, but now we cut the tether. So the idea is that with the AUVs, we want them to be fully autonomous. So we usually use them to do what we would call large area surveys, where with the ROV system, because it has a tether to a surface ship, wherever the ROV wants to go, the ship has to go with it. And so it's not a very good system if you want to survey kilometer scale environments, whereas the AUVs are very well designed for that task because they don't have a tether. They're free swimming robots. The disadvantage that you have with the AUVs is that because we cut the tether, all the computational aspects has to be on board now in the vehicle, so all the smarts has to be down here, as well as we don't now, from a power standpoint, we're running on batteries. Okay, so and when it comes to doing optical imaging from a platform like this, I can't afford now to basically have continuous illumination from the AUV. Rather, now I want to basically strobe my light source, because with every flash that I take, I'm expending energy. And so instead of running at video frame rates like you might normally have an ROV, here, well, you basically run with the camera system at, you know, more like one frame per second or something like that, basically trying to get just enough overlap that we can do something from a computer vision standpoint to register the imagery, but not any more than we really need. And so then there's a variety of scales that we use or are interested in when it comes to mapping, ranging from single images. So here's an image from an ROV of a hydrothermal vent, and we're seeing the tube worms there. This is a single image of trying to assess scallop populations. So these images are kind of ranging in size from like this is about a meter or so in scale, maybe a few meters or so in scale, to now here's we're looking at a whale carcass. Okay, and so you can see if you look closely, right, you can see this kind of jagged edge in the imagery. So this is actually not a single image, this is a mosaic. So here you've actually stitched together several images. Okay, so we're looking at kind of 10 meter scale or so. So here is a photo mosaic of the wreck of the Titanic. Okay, and this is constructed from several hundreds of images. Okay, and again, now we're talking about kind of 100 meters in scale. So now here's an acoustic map, basically, of the continental shelf edge off the U.S. eastern seaboard. And so this is ranging in kilometers of scale. So we're interested in navigating a robotic system over a variety of different scales, okay? For what I would call micro-navigation, okay, very precise localization over scales like this, to very kind of large-scale macro-scale navigation. And so there's different techniques that we use to try to navigate a robotic system over these kinds of scales. So our motivation for trying to navigate a robot precisely in an underwater environment is, one is that, you know, with the modern advent of GPS, you know, every little cell phone now has GPS. You would think that this is an easy done problem, right? Well, water is opaque to the radio waves that upon which GPS relies, so we don't have that as available. Moreover, the kind of instrumentation that we carry on a robotic platform like this, such as the cameras or the sonars, they often have they're very high resolution sensors. Such that if our navigation resolution is low, if we have poor navigation, we'll not be able to construct very accurate maps, because basically it will be all the navigation error. If we don't know exactly where we are, once we try to place all the sensor data in space, we'll get a very incoherent map. It'll look very blurred. So we like to basically maximize the utility of our scientific sensors by basically increasing the precision of which we know where the robot is in space to build these maps very accurately. In terms of navigation sensors, here's a table that kind of lists things that you'd be interested in terms of knowing state for a robot, such as, XYZ position, depth being Z, attitude, so roll, pitch, and heading, as well as accelerations and body frame velocities. And this table is kind of color-coded to show you that there's different sensors that we can basically buy and strap onto a vehicle. And they're quantified now in terms of how easy they are to measure. And typically, as you go in this scale of being more difficult to measure, the sensor price is also increasing, okay, pretty dramatically. So let's kind of go over this table and look at a quick overview. So in terms of easy things to measure, one would be pressure, which gives you basically depth, okay, below the water surface. So you can instrument this with either a strain gauge or a quartz crystal. And so this is a sensor that is fairly easy to basically know depth with a robotic system in an underwater environment. Attitude It kind of breaks or spans this easy to hard category. So easy would be roll pitch. Basically, measuring with respect to the local gravity vector, you can easily extract roll pitch orientation of the vehicle. Heading moves us into the hard to measure kind of category. Because now we're going to be trying to measure the Earth's, so in this case, we're using a magnetic attitude sensing technology. We're measuring basically Earth's magnetic field and trying to use that to derive, basically it's a compass, right? We're going to use that to basically derive what's our orientation with respect to north. Why is this difficult to measure? Well, with a magnetic field, there's two basically sources of error that we have to be concerned with. So variation basically refers to the fact that magnetic north and true north, okay, do not typically coincide, okay? And so this is what we call variation. So basically, and if any of you are sailors or have looked at navigation charts, you'll usually see something like this, basically on any kind of chart that basically is showing what is the magnetic north relative to true north, okay? And this is giving you a depiction of the variation. So here, if we look at it over the continental US, these are lines, basically, of constant variation, okay? So that you can see here that if I'm in this, so I'm from Michigan, okay, so if I'm in this region and I want to, basically, if I have a magnetic sensor in my robot, when it says that it's actually measuring north, it's actually 5 degrees off west from true north, okay? And moreover, the Earth's magnetic north, the North Pole, we define to be the north, you can see that it's actually, through time, wanders, okay? So this is plotting it basically from the 1600s through 1700s all the way up to now the 2000s. So you can see that basically what we define to be the magnetic north, okay, is something that's actually a moving target over these kinds of timescales. There's also something called deviation, which is basically the local effects, okay? So not only do I have to worry about then the variation due to the Earth's magnetic field, but also local effects due to other sources of magnetic fields in the environment, such as if I'm on a robotic system, for instance, if I have thrusters, right, they're producing their own magnetic fields. So I'd like to try to keep my compass as far away from the thrusters as possible to reduce that effect. As well as like in that my application of ship hull inspection, right? I'm gonna take this robot, I'm gonna drive up to this big, huge, hunking hull of a ship, which is iron, right, steel. And so that's gonna create, warp, distort the magnetic field greatly, okay? So that's why using, trying to measure heading is a somewhat difficult task. What you can do is if you move up in the level of expense category, is go to what's called a north-seeking gyro compass, okay? So I should back up and just say that. So these sensors are on the kind of order of like 100K US dollars, right? Fairly cheap. And if you want to be able to get a very fancy heading orientation sensor, you can move into the scale of a ring laser gyro or a fiber optic gyro, which is using a totally different effect to measure orientation. It's not reliant upon the Earth's magnetic field at all, okay? Unfortunately, I deleted my slide here that kind of went through the theory a little bit. But basically, the take-home message here is that we can move up in an order of magnitude in terms of the price point. Right now, we're talking about to have a sensor that basically allows me to measure heading to kind of 0.1 degree accuracy and be impervious to hard iron effects. So, for instance, on the robot that I'm going to be talking about for our ship hull inspection problem, we have a ring laser gyro on it, so that when we drive up next to the hull of the ship, we're not affected by the local magnetic field or disturbance caused by the hull. But we're talking about now that the price point's gone to now like 30 to 80K US dollars. So very expensive. And now into the very hard category is trying to measure X, Y position. So one traditional way to do it would be to use an inertial navigation system. So the idea is that with an IMU, basically a strap-down sensor like this. This allows you to measure very accurately accelerations, okay? And if you can then doubly integrate that, you can then get a position estimate, okay? So these sensors are also, if you want to have an accurate inertial navigation system, again, you're looking at the price points that are like 75K to 250K US dollars. So very expensive in order to have an accurate inertial navigation system. Because here we're basically talking about, it's like, as a human, right, close your eyes and start walking around this room, right? How well am I going to know where I am, right? Well, to have a sensor that basically allows you to know your X, Y position, with have it grow with a small amount of uncertainty, you're kind of moving in this regime that the more expensive sensors you have to buy in terms of being able to really measure very accurately the accelerations, okay? But the problem with any inertial navigation system, doesn't matter how much you want to spend, is that your error growth is always going to be unbounded. So no matter what, I mean, so it depends on the kind of time scale that you're interested in, right? If I'm interested in like a 20-minute kind of time scale with a sensor like this, you know, I can slow in the vehicle I'll talk about Wednesday, which is the Ford autonomous vehicle. There we have an inertial navigation system where we can drive basically 20 minutes, you know, around the urban environment, come back to the starting point, and only be off by, you know, maybe 20 centimeters at most, just free inertial, right? But that's a $150,000 inertial navigation system. But however, if we take that same vehicle now and we drive around for 20 hours, right, I'm going to be off by several meters, okay? So it depends on what kind of time scale you're interested in. So basically, error growth is always going to happen with inertial navigation system because anytime I have any error in the acceleration measurements, when I doubly integrate those, eventually that's going to bleed into my position estimate. Another traditional sensor used in the underwater environment is the Doppler velocity log. And it's basically making use of the principle of the Doppler shift, right? So if you've ever heard like a train go by with a train whistle, right, and you hear that change in pitch, right, you've heard the Doppler effect. So the idea with this acoustic sensor here, this is we call it a DVL. Basically, each one of these is an acoustic beam, and we're going to shoot sound energy out into the environment, okay, directed along each one of these beams. And what this sonar is going to measure then is the change in frequency of the sound energy coming back, okay? And that's basically allowing you then to measure the relative velocity of this beam with respect to whatever's in the environment. So typically for us, we're shooting the sound energy at the seafloor, which is stationary. And so what this is allowing us to measure then is the body frame velocity of this sensor with respect to the seafloor. So we would normally need three beams to basically resolve all the three body frame components, so basically forward, sideward, and vertical. And it has a fourth beam in there for redundancy, that you basically do a least squares estimate and get a measurement of error. So basically with the Doppler velocity log, what we have is that this is basically measuring the body frame velocity in the instrument frame. So here D for Doppler instrument frame, okay? And so then to map that to a world frame velocity, we basically have to have a coordinate transform from instrument to vehicle, and then from vehicle to world. And then once you have that transformation, you can now integrate basically velocities in the world frame to give you position, okay? So let's look at each one of these terms, okay? Because each one of these is a source of error in our navigation system. So the one here is basically the raw velocity measurement. How accurate can we make this? And actually, the Doppler velocity log is a fantastic sensor. Typically, the accuracy in the velocity measurements from a DVL are around the order of like 4 to 5 millimeters per second. Okay, so they're usually typically very accurate if you work with some of the higher frequency DVLs. The other thing you need to know pretty well is basically what the sound velocity calibration is, because if you have any error in what you think the sound speed velocity profile is underwater, that will also contribute then to error in the velocity estimate. The next term here is basically the rotation. This is a static coordinate transform from instrument to vehicle. This is something that you want to basically go through a calibration phase and try to estimate and come up with what you think is a good estimate of the sensor to vehicle transform. But this final one is really the weakest link in a DVL navigation system, because this is vehicle to world. So we need to know very accurately the roll pitch, heading orientation of the vehicle so that we can map these velocities to the world and then integrate. And so you can see what's coming back here is basically heading, right? So heading tends to be the weakest link or the largest contributor of error to a DVL navigation system. So the big difference between using a DVL, say, with a magnetic compass versus a ring laser gyro system is the difference between, say, like 5% kind of navigational error versus 0.1% of distance travel. And so again, with the Doppler navigation system, usually you're looking at error ranges of like this, 0.1 to 5% of distance traveled. Also, we can't use it everywhere. So basically, with the Doppler velocity log, we're shooting sound energy at the seafloor and measuring the reflection coming back up. So for instance, we have to be near the bottom, right, to use a sensor like this. So if you're trying to deploy a vehicle in the open ocean, right, and there's say 2,000 meters of water depth, right, we can't use it really accurately in a bottom reference navigation mode until we get to the last 25 meters off the bottom, okay. And then finally, with the DVL, just like with the IMU, basically air growth is a function of time. Okay, that's just another thing to point out, because we're integrating velocity to get position. So what do we do if we really want to have a position estimate that does not have air growth with time? Well, we basically deploy our own water version of GPS. We're going to use what's called a long baseline acoustic navigation system. So we're going to deploy on the seafloor, these are acoustic beacons, okay? And we're going to use the principle of time of flight and the geometry, known geometry of these beacons to basically localize the vehicle. So this is the depiction of, say, doing an ROV operation, okay, in the deep sea. Well, here would be the ROV. This would be the umbilical between the ROV and what we call the depressor weight. And then here would be the basically steel cable that runs and spans basically the, you know, kind of 2,000 meters between the depressor weight and the vehicle. So the principle here is this. Basically, the vehicle will transmit a ping at a unique frequency, so say 9 kilohertz. That sound energy will propagate out into the ocean. And then when each of these beacons hears that ping, it will reply on a unique frequency. So this beacon will reply at 11 kilohertz, and this one will reply at 10 kilohertz. What that allows the vehicle to measure then is basically the two-way travel time between it and this beacon, that and this beacon. And so based upon the known geometry of the beacons in the environment then, we can then triangulate and compute a position fix for the robot. And so with the DVL navigation system, you can usually get an error performance that looks something like this, where it's essentially bounded error, okay? So the vehicle can be down subsea for an extended period of time, but error will always be fixed, okay, or bounded. It won't have its error growth of time. Now the quality of the navigation can vary significantly, okay? It can, you know, an extremely good LBL system, you'd be very lucky to get 0.2 kind of meters of standard deviation in terms of position. More typical, it's usually on the order of a meter. Can be as bad as up to 10 meters, okay? Depending on how well you really know the geometry. So basically, when you deploy these beacons on the seafloor, you have to survey them with the ship to try to figure out what the geometry is of the beacons, as well as other things that can contribute is how well do you know the sound speed profile. So there's a number of factors that go into having a quality navigation fix. All right. So that kind of summarizes what would be traditional underwater navigation methods. So basically, you can see they rely heavily on the instrumentation side. Okay. The next topic I want to talk about is SLAM, which SLAM stands for Simultaneous Localization and Mapping. And the idea here is to think about using our perception. Okay, so we're going to assume that we have a sensor like a camera or a sonar, okay, or a LIDAR, as I'll be talking about on Wednesday, that allows us to measure or basically make measurements relative to the environment. Okay, now there's a lot of things that have to go into the perception side in terms of what we call features in the environment. But the idea is basically use our perception system to basically make maps and infer the geometry of the environment and try to use that for helping the robot to localize. So the SLAM problem here is basically that what we have as inputs is basically we have an idea or a notion of the robot controls. Okay, possibly that could be, you know, the controls could be as simple as knowing basically the odometry, okay, of the robot. And then we're going to be able to make observations using the camera or our perception sensor of nearby features in the environment. And what we want to estimate jointly is a map of the features and the trajectory or the path of the robot, the state of the robot. So applications of SLAM, there's been a lot of work in this community since the late 80s, you know, kind of early 90s. And it's been a hot topic in robotics. And a lot of it started off, you know, a lot of people doing kind of indoor SLAM systems. And so you'd see a lot of the pictures like this, like these kind of 2D representations of the indoor office environment. But really, where it has a lot of, you know, a very strong application is thinking about undersea, underground, space. Right here, we don't have GPS at all, right? So we really have to rely upon alternative methods for trying to navigate the robotic system. There's many different representations that you can use in a SLAM framework, ranging from, these would be grid maps. So these grid maps can be either 2D, okay, all the way up to 3D representations. And there's also then what we call landmark-based, basically trying to track point features in the environment. So here's a basic cartoon illustration of SLAM. So if here's going to depict my robot. And for the time being, let's assume that these are some features in the environment. Now, if I navigate using just dead reckoning only, so this could be my DVL, this could be my IMU system, right, and I navigate. Basically, this is representing my error covariance ellipsoid, okay? And you can see that basically the size of that ellipsoid is just growing with time. So as the robot navigates with time, it becomes more uncertain in the absolute navigation frame of where it is. So the idea behind SLAM is that using our perception, I want to try to build a map concurrently with trying to figure out where the robot is. So you can imagine at this time step, I'm using my perception sensors. So you can imagine here, I'm going to start off, and so I have zero error in my pose, in my state, right? I'm going to say I'm going to start from here, call that zero. So you can imagine at this time instance, if I were to sense some landmarks in the environment, I can place those landmarks into the map with the uncertainty associated with basically the uncertainty of my perception, okay? So you can imagine, for instance, I was measuring here, say, range and bearing to the sensor. That allowed me to place it in space. And again, I'm showing the error covariance ellipsoid of it. As the robot navigates, it becomes more uncertain in its own position. We use perception now to sense new landmarks in the environment and place those into the map. And you can see that the error covariance of these landmarks is larger, right, than these, because this has built into it not only the error in perception, but also it's convolved with the error in my own state. The core idea behind SLAM now is to use perception to sense landmarks that I've already placed in my map at an earlier time that had lower error uncertainty, right? By reobserving these, I can now reduce the error in my own state estimate. And because the error in these landmarks is correlated with the own error in my own position, I can reduce now the error uncertainty in these landmarks as well. And so the idea behind SLAM is to try to basically do this concurrently. We want to build up a map of features in the environment, use our perception to recognize these features through time, and use that to both bring down the error in the robot state as well as bring down error in the map. So why is SLAM a hard problem? Well, one, this is a joint estimation problem. Okay, so the error in building the map and the error in the trajectory estimate of the robot are correlated. Okay, so we need a way to basically represent that efficiently, okay, computationally. Another big problem in SLAM is this idea of data association. So when a robot basically senses features in the environment, and so here we're depicting, say, we have three features in the environment, and the robot has this much kind of uncertainty in its own pose, okay? How does it know to associate these two feature measurements with these two particular features versus these, right? So given the uncertainty of the robot's state estimate, both of these could be plausible configurations, okay? And so trying to, so basically we have no oracle telling us, okay, what the association is between measurements of features and which true features generated those measurements. So this can become a pretty hard problem to basically think about trying to model multiple hypotheses and try to track this through time. And making wrong data associations, depending on the kind of framework that you have for doing the SLAM inference, can be catastrophic, okay? So there are certain representations that allow you to like the, I say, a Kalman filter framework, where if we make the wrong data association, basically your filter blows up, okay? Versus if you something maybe like a fast SLAM or like a particle filter, it's a natural framework for basically not trying to track a unimodal PDF, but a multimodal PDF. And it is typically able to better at handling wrong associations. So that brings us now to actually looking at our particular formulation of SLAM, which is going to be a post-graph representation. So the idea here is that on this underwater robotic system, we have all these sensors that I kind of talked about and gave you some background on available to us on a robotic platform like this. Okay, so when I have these sensors, I'd like to try to use them, right? What I want to try to use my camera system for is to basically augment my navigation. Okay, so I'd like to, in this case, oftentimes we're working with a scientist when we're collecting this data or this imagery from the AUV. So for instance, here we're maybe working with the deep sea archaeologists, and they're really interested in collecting imagery of these. These would be amphora, okay, on the seafloor. At the same time, I'd like to use this from an engineering standpoint to help the robot navigate, right? I have all this great data here where clearly as a human, you can see there's this overlapping imagery, right? So if I can do the computer vision registration, can I somehow use this to basically bound the error growth or help me observe the error growth, okay, in my navigation system and try to correct for it? So the basic concept behind what we call VAN, visually augmented navigation, okay, is that if we do a pure dead reckoning system, right, the robot thinks that it drove this black trajectory, right? And so it's doing closed loop control on its own state estimate, and it's always going to look perfect, right? But in reality, if an oracle, right, were to really tell you the true state of the robot, you'd see that it didn't drive this black trajectory perfectly. It actually drove this gray trajectory. Okay, but the problem is that with the dead reckoning system, this is not observable. We have no way of actually knowing the true error in the system. Okay. The idea behind using the SLAM framework is that we want to try to basically, by registering images that have overlap at different instances of time, okay, so they have spatial overlap, it gives us a chance to basically observe this error in the state estimate. Okay, it gives us a chance to basically observe what this pose is relative to this pose. It gives us a measurement, which in the proper kind of state estimation framework allows us to come up with an estimate for the trajectory that more closely resembles, right, the actual trajectory, which is the gray one. So here's our intuition behind the visual SLAM, is that if we're using odometry only, right, this is, again, the kind of green trajectory, and if we were to plot error covariance ellipsoids, they would be growing, okay, as we navigate in this direction. These red links are meant to depict, basically, if we're able to do the perceptual registration, we can basically now augment our estimation framework, not only just the dead reckoning, but also adding these perceptual constraints. So here, if we take these two nodes, they belong to these two images, right? This is the images from the hull inspection problem. Okay? So first off, we're doing some image processing to basically bring up the signal to noise kind of content in the imagery. What you're seeing here are now the matched features, okay, between the images. And if depending on what kind of model that we're using, either epipolar or, say, a homography model for how these point correspondences tell us something about the camera geometry, we can basically extract the relative pose now of these two camera systems, okay, from those images. And furthermore, if we're interested in this, we can actually reconstruct the structure, okay, that goes with those point correspondences. So we're using the camera system to basically provide a relative pose constraint modulo scale, right? So we're basically measuring the translation direction vector and the relative orientation. So you can think of this being the relative Euler angles, okay? So a typical strategy for doing state estimation would be a Kalman filter framework, where normally you think about having a fixed size state vector. So this would be the vehicle state. And I've partitioned this into what I call the pose variable. So this would be X, Y, Z, roll pitch heading, and then kinematic. Okay, so these would be body frame velocities and body frame angular rates. Okay, and we would basically be approximating our state as being a normal distribution. Okay, so parameters by mean covariance. You would have a state space model, basically, that describes the open loop or the dynamics of how the state evolves in time. And then we have what's called an observation model. Z basically is basically a stochastic projection of our state. Okay, and this would be the Kalman filter, basically predictor corrector kind of framework, where basically we make essentially open loop predictions of how we think the state's going to evolve based upon our dynamics. Right, so basically we're taking this distribution, predicting it forward in time. So here we have the Gaussian distribution. Based upon open loop dynamics, it evolves, okay, in time and kind of spreads out, right, because we become more uncertain. And then we have the correction phase. So basically now we have our open loop prediction, we have an observation that comes in, and then when we fuse those two, we're able to come up with a fused estimate and kind of predict or correct some of the error in our state estimate. Now, in trying to use the Kalman filter framework for modeling our camera constraints, note that here the size of our state vector is fixed. Right, so we have the vehicle in these kinematic terms. If we look at what the camera is actually measuring, the way we're using it in our framework is we're using the camera basically to provide, so this would be showing you, clearly you can see this is a feature of it as a human you can recognize, right? And so we're doing this automatically, extracting hundreds of features and registering them. What we're getting is basically a relative pose constraint, okay, between two different instances in time from the robot's trajectory. So basically here at x of t and say x of t minus 2. Okay, so these are samples from the robot's trajectory when an image event happened, and we're able to make this relative pose constraint. So to use this in a Kalman filter framework, then we'd have to basically do what's called state augmentation. So if I want to try to properly represent my observation model, right, which is basically a relative pose between different instances in time from the robot's trajectory, then to properly describe that, I need to augment my state representation, such that when I ever have an image that I want to be able to use and re-register myself to at a later time, I need to clone my state and augment my state vector to have a representation of where I think I was at the time that that image occurred. Okay, and so basically you can see that our state representation grows with time for all images that we want to add to our map. Okay. And so then what happens in terms of our state description? So now our state consists of not only the current vehicle pose, but past historical samples, okay, from the robot's trajectory. So this is going to be parameterized now by a mean vector, right? And a covariance matrix, okay? So our plant model now basically looks, hasn't changed a whole lot. I mean, it's changed in a simple way. Basically, the current vehicle state continues to evolve by our open loop dynamics. But past states, right, they're going to be static and not evolve with time. We can now properly write our navigation measurements to be in function of our current state. Okay, and camera constraints then are measurements between two past states, okay, in the framework. Now, one thing to note, right, is in terms of our parameterization of this Gaussian distribution, we have the mean and we have this covariance matrix, right? So if I have n basically samples for my trajectory, I'm going to end up having this n by n covariance matrix. This will be important. Okay, so this covariance matrix is tracking all the correlation, okay, between samples from the robot's trajectory. So this was a nice experiment that we did several years ago at Johns Hopkins to kind of validate this framework. And the reason it was nice is that this was at Lewis Wicken's lab at Johns Hopkins. He has this test tank. He has this ROV. And one of the nice things about his setup is that he has a very precise long baseline navigation system for measuring truth, ground truth, basically. It's a 300 kilohertz LBL system, so it can measure basically vehicle XY position good to about a centimeter. Okay, so it serves as a nice ground truth. So basically what we did is we took the tank floor. We basically put down some artificial features. Okay, so it's amazing, you can buy anything on eBay, right? So these are actually landscaping rocks, okay, that we put down to create a kind of somewhat surreal underwater seafloor. So what we're seeing here is basically the robot did this kind of mowing the lawn pattern of doing a horizontal trajectory and then another one at 45 degrees relative to that. So the robot started here, and if you look at these, what we're depicting here are basically the 99% kind of covariance ellipsoids associated with a dead reckoning estimate. And you can see by the time it ends up, right, this would be the navigation error. Basically, it continues to grow monotonically throughout that whole sequence. This is the result from using the visual perception. Okay, so we're taking that same navigation data. And here, each of the red links, again, represents basically a relative pose constraint derived from the camera perception. Okay, and so when we fuse it in this augmented state Kalman filter framework, right, we're not only able to bring down the error in the current robot's estimate, but we're also, if you look at here, we're also plotting the covariance ellipsoids, which at this scale aren't really even visible. And we have ground truth. So overlaid in the back, I know it's kind of hard to see with this projector, but these little gray dots represent the Sharp's LBL system, okay, so our ground truth estimate. So you can see overall that there's a very good agreement, right, between the SLAM perception system and what we know to be ground truth. So here's an interesting kind of error characteristic. If we plot basically the determinant, okay, the XY determinant from our covariance matrix in the robot state versus time, right, in the dead reckoning system, you can see it's just going to grow monotonically, as you would expect. But if we plot the van state estimate, its determinant versus time, you don't see any kind of trend that's a function of time. Okay. However, if we plot the things now versus distance, okay, basically path length, okay, away from the what we call to be our base node. Okay, so the first image that we put down on the map, that will serve as our anchor image, right? If we plot basically an dead reckoning error versus that, right, you just get this scatter. It doesn't make any sense. But if you plot the van error, okay, relative to the first anchor node, you can see that basically the error, right, is basically how far you kind of navigated away from your reference node, okay, that you define to be your map, okay? So what's the price of doing inference with this kind of framework? Well, remember that covariance matrix was n by n, right? So it's growing quadratically in size. And what you're seeing here is the CPU time, okay, associated with doing each of our Kalman updates. Okay, so as we start to augment our state vector and grow it with time, right, each Kalman update is becoming more and more expensive, right? It's growing quadratically. Okay, so you can see that through time now, the number of updates here, this is showing you very nicely this quadratic growth, okay, in terms of update complexity. So basically, it's not a scalable framework. Okay, it has a nice property, right? The result that we got was what we wanted. Okay, allowed us to track the correlations in the graph, and allowed us to fuse the camera with the navigation data in a principled manner. Okay, but computationally, it just doesn't scale. So this is like a toy problem of like 100 images, right? And already we're not anywhere kind of close to being able to do this real time. And what we like to be able to do is we like to navigate things on not in the tank scale, this scale, right? We want to do this in the real world, right? So we want to take an ROV system, right? And we want to be able to survey shipwreck size kind of features. This is being a survey of the wreck of the Titanic. Okay, so this is the ROV that we're going to use, the Hercules. The kind of imagery or data that we're going to have is that the robot has a down-looking monocular camera system, so it's collecting this kind of imagery. What you're seeing here is the graph that's being constructed, right? So this is the pose graph, where links here are being represented as, you know, again, successful camera registrations from different instances in time, right? So here we're going to be at basically using the order of 1,000 images, okay, to navigate and represent this trajectory, okay? And what's kind of depicted up here are actually the different ways of navigating the robot. So it doesn't show up very clearly, but these gray dots are from an acoustic navigation system, a USBL system. I didn't talk about it in terms of the, but it is a traditional underwater navigation system. Basically, the surface ship is able to measure range and bearing to the AUV, or to the ROV, subsea. Now, this robot's in 3,700 meters of water depth. So if you have any kind of error in range and bearing, that's a huge moment arm, right, in terms of getting the XY position of the robot. So each of these squares is about 50 meters in size, right? So you can see that these gray dots are just kind of like a scattergram here. You know the robot's down there, but not very well where it is. The brown is the DVL trajectory. So the vehicle started here, did its mowing the lawn pattern, right? And the DVL, again, is a highly accurate sensor. So in this case, this robot has a ring laser gyro, right? It's got a very fancy attitude sensor. But what happened is they got to the stern of the ship, navigated back up towards the bow. Now remember, I said one of the things about the DVL is that it's going to be shooting sound energy at the seafloor, measuring the Doppler effect or the Doppler shift coming back. Well, they flew high enough in the water column that they lost basically Doppler lock, so their velocity estimate just went away. So what do you do for navigation? Well, they're during real-time ops, they reset it to a USBL fix, and so that's why you see this kind of hyperspace jump right in the vehicle state estimate. That's not real, right? This portion really belongs down here, okay? Now, the red is the result of the fusion now of that same data, the Doppler data, with the camera constraints. And you can see that we're able to basically produce a consistent trajectory for the robot. So the cool thing about the camera system here is that basically when the DVL lost its velocity estimate, right, what happened to our covariance ellipsoid? It went and it grew really big, right? So the camera system basically now is hypothesizing, I'm really lost. Instead of proposing my normal kind of five or so plausible camera links where I think I could be, let me open that up and now propose, say, 25 or 50, right? And basically do an exhaustive search. And the camera system is able to actually find the correct correspondence and registration and lock the vehicle state estimate back on, okay, to one of the early nodes in the graph and basically reset the navigation error. All right, and so that what the output that we can get out of this then is the trajectory of the robot, and after the fact, we can also reconstruct the structure of the environment, okay? And this is then back projecting the imagery onto this three-dimensional structure. Okay. So how to do this? So we're basically using the same framework, but we're being clever about how we use the Kalman filter framework. Okay, rather than using it in its typical mean covariance representation, we use it in an alternative parameterization called the information form. So basically, it's nothing more than if you take the normal distribution and we expand the quadratic up here, and basically this what we see is that we can actually rewrite this instead of writing the state in terms of the mean and covariance. By doing this expansion, we see that we can actually redefine some new variables here. So basically, the inverse covariance will be lambda, the information matrix, and this product here, basically mu times sigma, okay, or sigma times mu, we're going to transpose, we're going to define that to be the information vector. So it's an alternative parameterization of the Gaussian. But one of the nice things that has is it has this direct representation that in a dynamic Bayes net here, okay, here's our states. All the edges that show up in the graph, right, these are our camera measurements. In the information form, those correspond to off-diagonal non-zero elements. So the information matrix is basically encoding, it's the adjacency matrix for this graph, okay? So whereas the covariance matrix was n by n, and all the elements were filled, the information matrix is n by n, but the only non-zero elements are the number of edges in the graph. Okay, so typically this matrix is very sparse, okay? Computationally, the covariance and the information form have these duality kind of properties that in the covariance form, two fundamental probabilistic operations that you'd like to do are marginalization and conditioning, right? So if I have a distribution over alpha and beta, if this represented the covariance matrix, if I wanted to basically marginalize out beta, that just corresponds to extracting this alpha-alpha subblock from the covariance matrix. This same operation on the information form is much more expensive. We have to compute what's called the Schur complement. So to marginalize out beta in the information parameterization, I basically have to invert a block of the size of beta, basically the variables I want to eliminate. So expensive. Conversely, though, we've been talking about conditioning. In the information form, conditioning corresponds to basically just extracting the alpha-alpha block from the information matrix. A very simple operation to do, order one, right? Whereas in the covariance representation, again, we see this duality property, right? It involves computing the Schur complement. So basically cubic in the size of beta. When it comes to doing Kalman updates, so recall that our camera observation is basically a relative pose measurement between two different state elements in our state vector. So really, when we look at the Jacobian associated with it, it's very sparse, right? It only has a non-zero element between poses I and J. But when you do the Kalman update, it ends up changing all elements in the covariance matrix. However, in the information form, this is the equivalent update. The information form update is basically the outer product, okay, of the Jacobian with the observation covariance. And so what this ends up doing is basically in the information matrix, when I make a relative pose measure between I and J, I'm only adding these four elements to the information matrix, okay? Basically on the diagonal and this off diagonal. So what you get is, remember that graph of the Titanic? This is the resulting information matrix for it, right? The number of non-zero elements here is like 0.1%, okay, of the total number of elements of the matrix. Okay, so it's very sparse, right, the number of non-zero elements. So we get a big win in terms of computational storage, right? Instead of trying to keep around this n by n covariance matrix where everything's full, I'm keeping around this where the number of edges or the number of non-zero elements is basically the number of edges in the graph. So it's very sparse. So what's the price of lunch? Because nothing's free, right? The price of lunch is that when we're dealing with our plant models and our observation models, I need a point to linearize these models about, right? And the information representation, it's basically a non-dimensional version of state, okay? When I want to linearize my models, I want to linearize them about a point in state space, typically the mean. So I need to be able to basically recover the mean in order to do these linearization operations. So our parameterization is this, right? We have this information matrix and information vector, and this is the relationship between the information vector and the mean mu. So you can see that really this looks like AX equals B. It's a linear system, okay? So the fact that this information matrix is sparse, we can use this to our advantage to try to solve this system of equations to efficiently recover mu, our state. Moreover, we have an advantage here because I don't have to solve this solution in a batch mode every time, but at every time instance, I already have a previous guess of what I think the mean is, so I want to use iterative methods to basically update my estimate of what I believe the mean to be, mu. And so there's basically several methods in the literature that you can use that are efficient methods for trying to solve a system like this. Moreover, if we're operating in open loop and we don't have loop closures, then most of the graph is not changing with time. So we can actually partition our state into what I call the local map and the benign map. So basically, local map would be like the current state and the current kind of features around the robot or current poses. And the benign map would be like the rest of the graph, which is not really changing because I don't have any loop closures happening. So I can hold those estimates actually fixed, and I can use that to partition the system and basically solve suboptimally, okay, to update my mean for the local map, okay? And this is important because camera measurements are coming in at order 0.1 hertz, right? Every kind of 10 seconds, maybe. Whereas the navigation estimates are coming in at order like 10 hertz, okay? Or if it's the IMU, order 100 hertz, okay? So I'd like to be able to incorporate those very efficiently. And then with this kind of technique, we can do that. And then finally, covariance recovery. I'd like to have some notion about uncertainty so that I can try to hypothesize where I think might be overlapping images in the environment. And so to do that, what I'd like to be able to recover is basically what's the covariance in my own pose, and what's the covariance with, say, one of my delayed or one of my old elements in the pose graph and the cross-correlation. If I have that, then I can compute quantities like what's the relative distance between two nodes in the network, and statistically, what's the uncertainty in that relative distance. So to do that, basically you can see that what I really need from the covariance matrix is not the whole thing, but what I need to be able to recover is basically the diagonal, right, that gives me these elements. And what I'd like to capture is basically the current state's cross-correlation with those elements. So that means I need to recover this element. So we can, I don't want to just invert the information matrix and get the whole covariance matrix. That would just destroy all the efficiency of this framework, because that'd be a cubic operation to do inversion. So instead we're going to use the same trick. Basically, the information matrix and the covariance matrix is identity. So we can then use it to basically, if I want to solve for, say, this block column of the covariance matrix, I can basically say that I want to solve it for this basis vector, Okay, so E1 would represent the basis vector associated with the identity matrix of these columns. Okay, and again, you can see that this becomes now the same linear system, AX equals B. Okay, which we can use some of the same techniques that we've been using for recovering the state mu. We can use it now to also efficiently recover the robot's cross-correlation with all these elements, and we'll maintain then our estimates of the elements in the diagonal. I think let's take a break here, okay? And so part two, we'll move into now occupying this in the whole inspection task. All right? Well, welcome back, everybody. So now the second half of this talk, we'll look at basically applying a lot of that kind of background framework to the actual task of the visual ship hull inspection. So the first thing we'll talk about is basically a robust two-view registration framework. So basically, how do we derive these camera constraints? So some of the issues that we have to deal with in the hull environment is basically that it's the geometry of the scene that we're looking at can vary from being both planar to highly complex, like when we get by the rudders and screws areas. And we want to basically provide this 100% survey coverage by using the camera imagery to provide the posed graph constraints, okay, in the SLAM framework that we talked about. So some of the type of typical imagery, so this is actually an example of what I would call a very feature-rich dirty hull. So this is a mothballed aircraft carrier. So you can see that actually here, from a visual standpoint, right, it's actually very feature-rich. It's not very representative of a clean hull. And I'll show you data from a clean hull a little bit later. But the idea is basically this is the kind of sequence of imagery that the vehicle is collecting as it navigates along the hull, and this is what we want to use in a pairwise registration framework. Not only temporally, right, but those are of value, but really the thing we're trying to get basically is these kind of cross-track registrations. So basically as the vehicle is doing these horizontal slices or vertical slices on the hull, it's these cross leg-to-leg matches that really matter. So in the framework, basically we're using this pairwise registration framework where different instances of time, basically when we augment our state representation, that's going to be associated with an image at that time instance. And each of these images gets distilled down into a set of feature descriptors. Okay, so we're going to be using both a mixture of Harris and SIFT feature descriptors, okay, for describing the imagery. We're going to go through a RANSEC phase now where we try to fit basically what's the motion model associated with those putative correspondences. And that motion model can range from being basically, this is a calibrated camera system, so it can range from being an essential matrix, so the epipolar kind of geometry, or it can be a homography. So basically we use a model selection framework, okay, to see which model kind of fits the data better, okay? And then that's the one that we end up using. And so then what we get out of that by fitting that model then is basically what we supply to the visually augmented navigation then is this relative pose constraint modulus scale. Some of the peculiarities you have to deal with in underwater imaging in general, right, are one is lighting. So basically here we're looking at some imagery from an AUV. This is a black and white camera. This is a color camera. So usually we're using strobe lighting, okay, underwater. So you can see that the illumination field will be non-uniform. Okay, so we typically will get good contrast in the center, and then the imagery is or the illumination is basically decreasing very rapidly as we get towards the edges. This is basically due to the reason this looks so green is due to the basically attenuation of different wavelengths of light underwater. So basically red gets attenuated very fast as compared to blue and green. Issue of a backscatter, so if there's particulates in the water column, which is also really important to us in terms of the ship hull inspection because we're not usually working in deep water. In the hull environment we're working in kind of tends to be more nasty water that has lots of suspended sediments and particulates in it. Basically, when we flash, what will happen is we'll actually get a lot of the light source coming back to us, being scattered off particulates in the water column. So you can think about like driving in your car, right, and if it's fog, if you put your high beams on, all you'll see is like the fog, versus if you use your low beams, you'll tend to see more. So there's kind of a sweet spot, too, then when we try to do camera registration between the geometry of the light source and the camera system. So here we're looking at the same scene up close. These are the same amphora jars here, right? And so this is taken at, say, a couple meters. And if we back up 12 meters and try to take that same picture, you can see that we get a lot of this kind of salt and pepper noise due to the backscatter. And then also this issue of wide baseline. So if we're not running at video frame rates, basically the camera motion between successive frames is actually quite large. So here these are actually two successive frames from an AUV mission. we can see that this star versus that star versus. So basically we're looking at kind of like 30% overlap between the images. Just enough that we can try to do the registration between them, but not a whole lot more. So the feature extraction, basically we're using a quiver of SIFT and Harris detections. Okay, and those will serve as basically our feature detections. For the Harris points, in terms of trying to do the description side of it and do the feature encoding, we'll make use of the fact that this is a camera on an instrumented robot, so we can instrument fairly well the attitude of the robot. So because we know the calibration matrix K associated with the camera, we can construct what's called the infinite homography here, H infinity. And we can use this basically as a pre-warp on this image to basically create a synthetic view from the camera that has the exact same center projection, but from a different orientation. So we can use this basically to take an image like this and warp it to a canonical northeast down kind of coordinate frame, such that it's not going to remove the perspective effects due to the projective geometry, but allows us to kind of pre-compensate for the orientation. Okay. We try to exploit our navigation or our SLAM prior wherever we can in doing the feature correspondence. So here we use this two-view point transfer model, which is basically, this is the an exact two-view mapping between pixels in image I to pixels in image I prime, where if we could do this exact mapping if we knew scene depth Z. Okay? And so in the absence of knowing scene depth Z, what this essentially deteriorates to is the epipolar geometry between the two images. So the way we use this is that the parameters that make up this two-view point transfer, basically we can see the orientation shows up, the translation shows up, and scene depth shows up. So all those are known with some uncertainty. So we can do a first order covariance projection, okay, of the uncertainties associated with each of these terms to basically give us, if we know where this pixel location is in the reference image, we can project it into the other image with a first order covariance estimate of where we think it lies. So this U prime. So for instance, if we're trying to match these two images here, this feature point here, I can project it into this image, and this, so each line here represents the epipolar line. But this ellipsoid represents that if I know something about scene depth, which I can measure from my altimeter, then I can actually restrict my search to not be along the entire epipolar line, but along a short band of it. Okay. And so basically, if I'm trying to find this a match for this pixel, I only have to search within that ellipsoid with 99% kind of confidence bound. So this is important because a lot of the features that show up in the underwater environment are typically kind of non-discriminative. They're not. If you try to do a global search between these images, you'll get a lot of false putative correspondences, basically false appearance-based matches. But if we can constrain the search at all based upon our prior and our geometry, then our feature descriptor doesn't have to be unique across the whole image, right? It only has to be unique within this little ellipsoid. Yeah, Nuno. So the Harris, we tend to get a lot of matches temporally. So between sequential images, when the viewpoint doesn't change a lot, we tend to pick up a lot more matches. So that it helps just to augment basically our feature space, just in terms of getting the number of matches. It's really when it comes to these kind of cross-check matches that the Harris points aren't really contributing much at all. It's really the SIFT features. And on the cross-check matches, we're not trying to match necessarily every frame. As you'll see in some of the later imagery, it's only important that we make cross-check measurements every now and then, right, in terms of actually bounding the navigation error of the robot. So here's an example of this post-constraint correspondence search. So here you can see the features that are being extracted. And here, we're playing this at 1/8 speed, just so we can kind of see what's going on. This is from our visualization display. So you can see that basically here we're projecting points from one image into the next. And this represents the 99% kind of confidence bound that's being calculated based upon our SLAM prior information about the scene to help us restrict our correspondence search. And so then what we're seeing here is then these are the putative matches that are making it through that phase, okay, of the post-constraint correspondence. We're then going through the ransack phase and trying to fit either the central matrix or the homography model. And then these are the resulting features that are passing, making it through ransack. And so this is then the resulting relative pose measurement that's being made from the camera system and being fed then back to our SLAM state estimate. Okay, so here's showing this working on, this is a fairly large vessel. This is one of the heavy sea lift ships for the U.S. Navy that they would use to transport tanks and, like, you know, lots of kind of big equipment. So this is like a, I want to say a 300 meters long or so. And so what you're seeing is basically, this is a vertical slice survey, so we're basically starting and going down to the bottom, to the keel of the boat, so basically the bottom half, and coming back up. Each of these is spaced about 4 meters apart, these track lines. And so what you're seeing depicted here is the red links are representing successful camera registrations that are being made cross-track. The blue ones, the cyan ones, are hypothesized ones. So these are ones that we've attempted based upon where we think we should have some overlap in the imagery. And the red ones are successful. And so you can see when we make camera constraints, you'll see that basically we are not only improving the estimate of the current position of the robot, but you'll be able to see the whole graph kind of actually move a little bit and jiggle. Okay, as the trajectory is being resolved to be consistent with all of the relative pose constraints that are being generated. So this is the live stream of camera imagery that is coming in. Okay. I'll talk about this in a little bit. We call this periscope mode. So basically we have the camera mounted on top of the robot, so that when the robot actually comes to the surface, the camera pokes out of the water. Because the hull's a rigid body, so measuring pose, making camera measurements below water is equally as good as making camera measurements above water with respect to the hull of the ship. And so now you can see the graph starting to be kind of stitched up as we're coming back, okay, and driving across. So for instance, you'll see this kind of kink go away once we make a registration here and we update the graph. Exactly. So we don't have any prior knowledge. We're not using any prior knowledge of the model of the hull. And so this is then showing the discrepancy between the dead reckon estimate. If we just drove off the DVL, that would be this kind of greenish looking line here versus the slam state estimate trajectory, which is the blue. This is just showing the camera footprint. So again, just to pointing out that the camera measurements, we don't have any overlap, right, side to side, which is not important for our case. So really, in this, we're trying to... The survey pattern we're doing here is really optimized for the sonar. So the sonar has a much bigger field of view footprint on the hull, in which we're trying to get 100% coverage with the sonar system. And we're using the camera purely for a navigation standpoint. So whenever we loop back over these trajectories, we can use the camera system in these regions to provide constraints. So these are just showing some of the loop closure events that happened. So this is the resulting graph of, again, these are the proposed, the red are the successful ones. And then this is the resulting error between the dead reckoning, okay, and the slam estimate. So basically over this kind of time scale, this is about like 6 meters or so of kind of drift between those two estimates. So these are some of the features that are being recognized. So you can see like this loop closure event that happened here, right? These are the two pairs of images that were successfully registered automatically in this framework. So I've kind of highlighted here just so as a human we can actually pick out what's the same. But it's actually this kind of structure here. And so this is just showing basically the difference or the discrepancy between dead reckoning and the van estimate. So it gets up to about 6 meters of error discrepancy along the trajectory. Now this is showing actually now applying slam on a clean hull, right? So that first one I showed you was that mothball carrier. This is a vessel at Woods Hole, Oceanographic Institution, the Oceanus. This ship's about, I think, 70 or 90 meters long, 70. This is the imagery you're seeing now. So now this is a clean hull, right? So in terms of features that are on here, there's regions that have feature content, and then there's other regions that look just a lot like metal, right? Not much texture, right? So this is a bit more challenging for trying to use the camera system. Okay, so this is the resulting graph that gets constructed for that data set there. So you can see that there's regions of the hull where the camera system's working fairly robustly in providing a lot of good constraints to the navigation system. There's other regions of the hull, such as here, right, where the camera system basically has very low utility, right? It's basically not visually diverse enough in that region of the hull for the camera system to actually make registration measurements. Again, this is just showing the difference in terms of our error profile in the dead reckoning versus path length, right? So this is growing monotonically versus the van estimate. So even though we're not making camera measurements all the time, right, we can still bound the error growth of the vehicle's state estimate along the hull. Okay. So here's some example of different kind of registrations. So in this region here, right, here I'm going to show that from this first track line, these are basically sequential pairs of images. So here we have a very strong prior on our pose because our navigation estimate, right, our dead reckoning is going to be very good over short time scales, right, successive images, temporal. So, for instance, if I'm trying to register these images, first we'll do a little image processing to bring up the contrast. And you can see here, if I project my pose prior into image space, right, I have a very strong prior, basically, from the geometry on where to look for correspondences. So even though these don't look super visually distinctive, right, I'm able to make all these matches. So here, this is your question about Sif versus Harris. So the green ones are the Harris feature points, and the cyan ones here are Sif points that are being matched. So in the temporal imagery, we tend to use the Harris because it helps us augment and get a lot more matches temporally. Well, so we typically will kind of partition the image and break it up and do a grid pattern, basically try to extract a certain fraction of features from each one of those cells and kind of force some uniformity in the feature description and where it fires. So then this is the reconstructed pose. In this region, now we're going to look at, these are two cross-track images, so the one image from this leg and one image from this leg. But again, you can see that in the terms of our SLAM framework, right, the vehicle drove this way, and it's been stitching itself up pretty regularly coming back. So we've been able to keep our SLAM state estimate pretty well constrained in terms of knowing our pose error. Such that, again, when we try to match these images, we have a very strong prior, okay, from the geometry, right? So we're able to, again, make lots of matches, okay, between these images. Now, in this case, the vehicle's right now has come back. It's gone out again, and now it's been coming back, but it hasn't been making any cross-track registrations. So basically, we have dead reckoning error just accumulating in this region, right? And so we're going to be looking at two different cross-track images that we want to try to register. It's these guys. So now when we look at, so here I'm just kind of highlighting so as a human, you can kind of see where the correspondence is. If we project our pose prior into the space, it's basically non-informative. It doesn't really tell us, constrain the search at all. So here, we really have to rely upon the visual distinctiveness of the imagery itself, such that in this case, we're getting all these SIF matches, okay, between these images. And basically, based upon the image appearance alone, I'm really able to make that link and re-register the robot, and then I'll bring the error back down. Okay. So this brings us into talking about visual saliency. And this is going to be work with one of my PhD students, Ayong Kim. So the idea is when we look at the hull of the ship here, right, not all images are equal for SLAM. Okay, there's certain regions of the hull where they're it's very visually distinctive, right? And the camera perception system is able to work very well, okay, in terms of being able to make these kind of constraints. Okay, but there's other regions of the hull, such as here, where it's basically benign. There's not much to look at, okay, in terms of trying to make constraints from the camera system. So what we'd like to be able to do is to quantify this up front, such that from our SLAM navigation framework, I'd like to be able to have a metric, right, for each image that I want to add to my graph in terms of what's its utility for navigation. Because if the robot's lost, right, this is a camera on a robot. And so I'd like to couple the perception to control. Right? I'd like to be able to drive the robot to regions of the graph where if I'm starting to accumulate lots of navigation error, and if I want to basically bound it and bring it back down, where should I go? Right? I would like to go to regions of the graph where I think it's visually distinctive. So here the color coding is that red, hot, those are visually salient regions of the hull. Blue, cold, those are benign regions of the hull. So if the robot's lost, right, I don't want to go back here and try to get a loop closure. It's going to be low utility. I'd rather go back up into regions like here, here, here. So let's define how we can try to maybe quantify the saliency. So she's been working on using basically a bag of words technique that I'll talk about. So I don't know if you guys have covered bag of words yet, representations in your course, but basically the main idea is that there's been a lot of prior work in basically the document search community in terms of how do I take a document, right, and if I want to say I want to do a search and find all documents that are related to Apple, right, or like the computer company or iPads, right, then there's a way for basically kind of quantifying a document based upon the words that it has in terms of what is its overall content, okay, associated with it. So that I can do search queries, right? Such that when I say I want to try to find all documents related to Apple, I could actually do a query related to iPad, right? And that association would be formed such that it grabs me documents. So the same thing with visual images. So some of this early work in the early 2000s, okay, was Zisserman and Civic. In terms of trying to take this notion from the document search community and apply it to visual imagery. Where the idea is that we're going to take an image, right, which normally has a spatial kind of representation, but But instead, we're going to describe the image by its descriptors, where we take those descriptors and we basically project them onto a vocabulary of visual words, such that my document now, I can represent it basically by the words, the visual words that it contains. So I lose the kind of spatial representation of the image, but allows me to basically do queries. Okay. So the idea here behind this bag of words representation is that you take an image. Let's say we extract features. These would be, they say, SIFT features. Okay, they get extracted, right? So for each one of these firings, right, we get, these are the kind of regions where the SIFT feature detector is firing. Normally, now you would take that and you would compute the associated descriptor that goes with each one of those features. But at this point, what we do is we quantize it. Okay, so rather than retaining the actual feature descriptor that was associated with this, we project it onto a set of basis descriptors, which form our vocabulary. So that's basically, we go through this dictionary, right, and this descriptor gets translated to word 753. Okay, so we have quantize all the features into the size of our vocabulary. So each feature gets projected onto a word, okay, based upon this kind of lookup table. So the way we build this table is basically you can use some training data. So you can take a sequence of images. You basically, if we show where the features project into feature space, they tend to form clusters. So you can do something like k-means kind of clustering to basically partition the feature space. So each one of the centroids of these clusters then becomes what we would say a word, right? So now that when I take in any kind of feature descriptor, I'm essentially projecting onto the closest cluster, okay? And that gives me then a word, a visual word. Okay, so we want to try to apply this kind of bag of words machinery to helping us define saliency. And there's two measures of saliency that we want to use. One is local saliency, which is basically a measure of texture richness. So basically, what's the utility of using this image in a pairwise registration framework? So I'd like to be able to distinguish images like this, these kind of benign ones, from images like this, which are kind of feature rich. And so this is going to be a local notion of saliency in terms of what's kind of the feature content of any given frame. Okay. The second notion of saliency I'd like to define is global saliency, which is not a single image, but actually a stream of images. So here, this may look like a salient image because I see this kind of high contrast, kind of weld seam. But when I look at the actual temporal video of this, I see that seam everywhere, right? So when I look at it in the stream of data, all of a sudden it may have a high local saliency score, but in a global sense of all the data or all the imagery I've seen along the hull, it's not super unique, okay? Okay. So we're going to basically use this kind of bag of words representation where when I extract features from the image, okay, here I've kind of color-coded them by the word. So we can see we have two occurrences of word 3, two occurrences of word 4, okay, and so on and so forth. The basic idea is here is that we're going to look at histograms of the word content. Okay, so we're going to look at basically, for local saliency, we're going to look at the distribution of words, okay, contained within this image. Okay, and this will be, we're going to use a measure of entropy that I'll define next, to say, you know, how interesting, how varied is this imagery in terms of the words that it contains. And then we're going to define what's called a global saliency metric, which is, again, kind of a measure of entropy, but now looking at it relative to all of the image stream. Okay, so a little primer on entropy. So entropy basically provides us with a measure of surprise, okay, from a distribution. So the idea behind entropy is that we'll define here to be h of x, where x is the random variable. H is going to be our calculation of entropy, where I is defined to be information, okay, associated with the random variable I here. And this would be the probability of xi occurring. Such that what this measure of information is, it's a measure of surprise. So basically, you could think about this measure of information as being the log of 1 over p, okay? So 1 over the, so basically, what's the probability of x occurring, right? If p is very small, then if I look at 1 over p, right, that'd be a very large number. It has a lot of information. If I see that word, if that event happens, it tells me a lot, okay, because it doesn't happen very often. Versus if a word occurs with probability 1, or a event occurs with probability 1, then when I look at basically the log of 1 over p, right, that's the log of 1, 0 information content. Basically, it's almost an almost sure event. So here we can see if we compute entropy, basically it's, if you look at this expression, this is nothing more than saying the expected value of information associated with the distribution. Such that this distribution here, right, has zero entropy, right? Because all occurrences are, with probably one, always the same thing happens, okay? This distribution is the most random distribution I can get, basically a uniform distribution, okay? This is the most, so basically here, right, all states are equally likely to occur, okay? And then, so typically, this is the lowest entropy you can have, zero. This is the maximum entropy you can have. And then any other distribution is going to be somewhere in between those two extrema. Okay. So now we'll use this to define our local saliency bag of words measure. The idea is that we're going to take our image. We're going to basically compute or extract our features. So in this case, we're going to extract surf features. We're going to project them onto our vocabulary. And now I'm going to basically, for this image, this represents the histogram distribution over our vocabulary, okay, of the occurrence of words, okay, associated with this image. So I'm going to compute now the entropy score, okay, of this distribution. But see that for images that have a lot of variability, this is going to have a high entropy score because a lot of the words are occurring, okay? So it has a lot of content, right? A lot of the different words are showing up. So what I'm showing here is that there's been some previous work and also using entropy metrics where they have not used a bag of words representation, but instead they've been used measures of, say, like the hue kind of histogram. So hue is basically a different kind of color space representation where we can look at the hue channel, can look at, for a color image, look at the histogram distribution for hue. It also tends to be a pretty nice measure of feature content. So here we're looking at a color image that has a lot of information. Here's a color image that's pretty benign. And so we look at the hue histogram, it doesn't have a lot. It has a low entropy score. This is our bag of words histogram. Again, gives you a very low kind of entropy score because only a few words are occurring with a high frequency. However, the advantage we have with the bag of words representation is that it also works for black and white imagery, grayscale. So here, if we look at the intensity histogram, because now we can't map that basically to this hue kind of color space. If we look at the intensity histogram for this image, you get something that looks like this. Here's the intensity histogram for this kind of benign image. It also looks very similar, right? So you can't really distinguish based upon just grayscale intensity. However, with the bag of words representation, right, if I project this onto the feature vocab, I get this pretty wide distribution. And similarly here, this pretty benign image, I get a very low kind of distribution. So we have a nice way now of kind of quantifying what we measure to be our local saliency for any given image. The next thing is to look at what we call global saliency, and this is look at across the whole image stream. So all these images tend to be locally salient if we look at the feature content. So SL represents our local saliency score, which is normalized between 0 to 1, okay, so 1 being salient images. SG represents our global saliency score, also normalized between 0 to 1. So these images on the left-hand side tend to be more salient, okay, features. Versus images like this weld seam that we talked about earlier, tends to be less salient because we see it so often throughout the hull. So the measure here we're using is basically based upon a measure called inverse document frequency. So again, we're kind of computing an entropy kind of based score. You can think of it. But here, what this represents is capital N represents the total number of documents, okay, that make up our vocab. Okay, so this is the total number of images that we use to basically define our vocabulary for. NW is the number of documents, okay, containing word W. Okay, so when I look at my image stream, I'm going to basically I extract words ranging from 1 up to ND. Okay, and I'm looking at what fraction of documents contain that word, right? If all documents contain that word, that's 0, right? It doesn't have any utility, any information. However, if only one document contains that word, right, it has a lot of utility. It's very unique. Okay, so I can use this as a measure of surprise. And so when we were first kind of developing this and looking at this, Ayong, she basically took a camera and basically waved it around her grad student office, right? And so here's kind of a depiction of what this metric is firing on, okay, from that data stream. So what you're going to see is that when this is red, it's not salient. When it's green, it's salient, okay? So we can see this brick wall, we see that a lot in the environment, right? So basically this metric, when it fires on the image stream, it's not salient, okay? However, when she's going to pan down and now start to look at like her computer cluster and stuff here, right? Oh, that's new. We don't see those features very much, right? And they tend to fire as being visually distinct in a global sense. It's now starting to fire again. Okay. So when we apply this to the ship hull data inspection data set, now what we get is this kind of nice way to quantify the saliency of the image for navigation. So here's our graph. And this is the original graph. If we overlay our local saliency metric on it, we can see that our local saliency metric corresponds pretty well with regions that have, where we're making edges. Those are regions that have lots of texture, okay, in the environment. One of the next things we're starting to look at now is how to combine this with a measure of information gain. So geometrically, we can look at what would be the utility of adding an edge to the graph here. And that can give us a measure of information gain. But now we can also fuse that with, well, what's the likelihood if I actually go there that I'm going to be able to make that camera measurement in the first place, right? Because it's not just, if you think about information gain, it's just measuring basically the geometric property. If I were to go there and add an edge to the graph, what value would that have? But now I can also consider, well, how likely am I to make that edge in the first place from the camera? Because not all images are created equal. So again, this is showing it for this kind of Curtis data set, where this is now, again, the local saliency kind of measure that we see. So what we see is that on the side of the hull, when the vehicle is doing these vertical slices, these are essentially visually kind of benign areas. They're color-coded blue. They're not very useful for imagery. It's really the bottom portion of the hull that has a lot of this kind of feature content that you see there. Also, the camera, we're operating in what we call periscope mode here. So you can see the camera's actually mounted on top of the vehicle. So when it comes to the surface, it pokes out of the water. So at, also at the top surface of the water is also where we get very visually kind of distinct features. Here's a measure of the global saliency now. So if we compute that global saliency metric and then look at it for the Oceanus data set, what we find is this, basically that, you know, these regions here, those kind of benign images, we see them a lot in this region, okay? The weld seam, for instance, ends up showing up with a kind of a lower saliency score. But features like this, these kind of port openings things, things that we don't see very often in the hull, they light up as being kind of unique. So if the robot's really lost, we're thinking that we'd like to use this kind of global saliency metric for servoing the vehicle back to regions like that, where we think it'd be very visually distinct in trying to relocalize the robot. Here's applying it to this global, this is applying both measures now to this inspection of this Coast Guard vessel here. This is the local saliency map. So basically, again, we're just measuring based upon a single image, what's its kind of texture content for registration. And in this hull, it tends to have a lot of kind of marine growth on it. So it tends to be lights up and says that it's locally salient everywhere. I mean, it's good for kind of a registration standpoint. If we look at it in a global sense, though, right, we tend to see this kind of coral stuff everywhere along the hull. So in a global sense, it's not very useful for navigation if you're really lost. One of the neat things that kind of came out of this is actually, so in this project, the reason we're doing ship hull inspection is for foreign object detection. So really, you know, we're trying to find the mines that the bad guys are putting on the hull, right? So we did not in any way try to write any kind of image-based detector for detecting mines. But actually, out of this global saliency metric, what came out of it by naturally was that this thing lights up and fires whenever we see like mine-like objects on the hull, because we don't see those very often. And so we get our global saliency metric actually scores pretty high when features like that happen. So that was kind of a nice byproduct. I think in the essence of time, let me just kind of skip ahead and wrap up here. Let me just show you. So this is the our concept for basically extending the same machinery for when we have a turbid water. So if the water quality is not very good for doing registration underwater, we have what's called periscope mode for the camera. So the basic idea is we have the camera mounted here on top of the robot, okay, with a little sun shield. But the basic idea is that the hull is a rigid body. So when we make camera registrations below water, it's equally as well as to make registrations to the above water portion of the hull. And so basically, whenever the vehicle pops up to the surface, it gives us an opportunity to use the camera system to basically make constraints like this, and then feed that back to the SLAM state estimate. So with that, let me just wrap up here. So basically, kind of give you an overview on what would be traditional underwater navigation methods and some more advanced methods related to SLAM. Basically, how can we bring in the perception sensors that we have, which tend to be highly accurate, the cameras and the sonars. And really, what we're trying to do in the SLAM framework is really exploit and extract that high precision in the sensing to help us see something about the robot's own state. We talked about this kind of visual saliency measure. And the thing I kind of skipped out here was this idea of a multi-view registration. And so I'll be happy to take any questions. This is one of the robots that we have in my lab back at Michigan.
Thank you very much. So I have a question that is related somehow to one of the topics of the course that the students were dealing with, which is with this configuration that you have, you never rotate your camera. So your camera is always looking up front, and you cannot move. And you
correct. Yep.
When you use your SIP descriptors, do you constrain the rotation?
No, we don't. I mean, so we could try to exploit that. And so basically, they don't have to be essentially rotationally invariant. However, we haven't tried to exploit that.
Because in theory, you will come out with more robust estimates by just constraining the degrees of freedom that you know your phone doesn't have.
Correct. Well, so we're trying to write, so my goal with developing this kind of SLAM framework is that right now I've been funded on this project to develop for the ship hull inspection by the U.S. Navy. But my ultimate goal is I really want this to run on my robots, which are have a down-looking camera system looking at the seafloor. And it should be the exact same framework. And there, I need to be rotationally or be invariant in the sense that my vehicle is going to be flying on reciprocal headings and whatnot. So that's why I kind of haven't tuned it so much for particularly the hull inspection application. I'll try to keep it a little more general. Yeah?
When the robot is like going through a benign portion of the image and it somehow gets lost and then uses the previously robust part of the registration to trace back, to localize back. But isn't this a kind of a loop that if you don't like again come to that position and he will like lost himself again and just goes back? Or, I mean, how does it work?
Let me just flip back. Yeah, so you're talking about like this region here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, so basically whenever the robot navigates into this region, we're really relying upon the dead reckon navigation sensors of the robot. So this robot has that Doppler velocity log on it. So it's able to measure and integrate its own velocity over this period of time to get an estimate of where it thinks it is. So the error growth on that system is kind of like 1% distance traveled. So basically the idea with the camera system is that by fusing the camera system with other navigation sensors on the robot, it allows us to work robustly in environments like this, where now I kind of have to rely more upon my dead reckon inertial navigation system. However, whenever I'm able to come back, say here, or if the robot was to deviate and come back into this region, right, the navigation system provides me with I'm going to accumulate quite a bit of error, say in my state estimate. So I'm not going to have that very strong kind of geometric constraint in how these images match. But I'm going to rely more than upon the appearance-based descriptive utility of these images. So just like when I showed you like these links that happened here, right? The image was actually pretty visually distinct, such that without any pose prior at all, just based upon putative matching, based upon appearance, I'm actually able to make that constraint. And once I make that constraint, right? So here, if I were to plot versus time the covariance ellipsoid, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? But now when the robot comes back and makes that link, boom, I just brought the error down to basically this level, right? And because I'm keeping all these states in this filtering framework, I also reduce, because of the correlation between all these states, I also reduce this uncertainty too, such that the maximum certainty is going to end up being here. Does that kind of make sense?
So it's like when it's not localized, in that case it relies on that reckoning and it like moves along and just localized where it finds the same kind of image that was previously registered, something like that.
Yeah. So we don't have to make camera measurements all the time. So in this case, because the robot does have a fairly accurate dead reckon navigation system, we can use the camera essentially kind of fairly sparsely, as you can see here, to really constrain the navigation error. So it doesn't have to make measurements all the time between these tracks for it to have a high utility for bounding the navigation error.
I have a question regarding the global.
Yeah. Well, so we build our vocabulary online. So we start with a small seed vocabulary of say like a 1,000 word kind of database, and as descriptors come in, we basically project them onto our vocabulary. And for words that have basically pretty far in terms of projecting onto a good cluster, we add a new word.
And so that was one of the questions. The other one is, with that, do you reason that this word trying to match previous images that you disregarded? They were not as salient before as they are at the end. I mean, do you try to revisit the
establishing link based on that? So this saliency measure, right now we've, in truth, we've kind of used this as after effects. So right now the real-time SLAM system doesn't actually compute this online. This is something we want to move towards in terms of actually trying to couple this in with the path planning. So I think we have some nice kind of preliminary results that show that this could make a lot of sense. In terms of trying to move this into the real-time system, but we haven't done that yet. But our idea for using this is that we want to use this measure of both local and global saliency such that, what slide did I have? Yeah, so here you can, there's like measures of like information gain that you can compute. Like if you were to imagine adding the edge to this network, you can kind of compute what would be the reduction in uncertainty in the graph by adding that edge. And what we'd like to overlay on top of that now is both our measure of local saliency, how well we think the images could be registered, as well as the measure of global saliency. In the sense that if we're going to be driving long distances to get back to that region in the environment, I think the global saliency measure will be useful for basically how unique we think that portion of the environment is. We're trying to get back to it. Well, so yeah, exactly. So we only basically update the vocabulary that is used to build our global saliency score based upon basically a spatial decimation. So because we know our SLAM say estimate, we know where the image field of view is projected onto the hull, right? So if I just stop here and just stand at this thing, so maybe I think initially that this light switch is interesting, right? I don't want to keep basically adding words to my vocab in terms of occurrence of them, just because I keep standing here and looking at this thing. Basically, I update the distribution of my global kind of occurrence of words in the vocab is spatially distinct regions of the environment. So only when I think that the camera's actually moved and I'm at a new field of view would I think about updating basically my global vocabulary. So I can do exactly that, just to avoid, if I stare at something, its global saliency would go down.
When you update the vocabulary, you need to recluster everything, or you do it incrementally?
We're doing it incrementally. Yeah, so we're not doing it.
Sometimes when you work with vocabulary, you might rethink previous clustering that you did, and you place
so,
merge.
Exactly. Yeah. So we haven't gotten to that kind of level of sophistication right now. So we're doing a very crude clustering, where it's really not like an optimal clustering in the sense that as we build it online, basically we're using Euclidean distance as kind of a proximity metric to which cluster we project on, and then adding a new node or a new word if it's basically a pretty far projection.
If it's not working in real time, probably you don't care.
We want this to be online. Yeah. So this is kind of like why we're trying to develop this for exactly is to do this online. Yeah, because the idea is that, doing these ship hull inspection surveys, it's not like we're going to be resurveying the hull or get many runs on it. It's kind of like a one-shot kind of deal, right? And so you'd like to extract as much out of the data as you can online in terms of improving the navigation estimate.
Okay, is there any other questions? No? Good, so thank you very much, Ryan.
Thank you.